Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Again, application developers are going to pick their trade-offs, right? There's a lot of devs that don't want to deal with the fragmentation of the L2 ecosystem and the design there, or they don't want to deal with the risk of an upgrade multisig on an L2 and things like that, right? L2s are not yet perfect.
This episode of The Protocol is sponsored by the Stellar Community Fund.
Dive deep into the blockchain realm with The Protocol podcast, with CoinDesk founding editor of The Protocol newsletter, Brad Cowan, and tech journalists, Sam Kessler and Margot Nykerk. They unravel the intricate technologies powering cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum, one block at a time. Just a reminder, CoinDesk is a news source and does not provide investment advice.
Hello and welcome to the Protocol Podcast. I'm Brad Cowan here with my co-hosts, Margot Nykerk and Sam Kessler. Excited to dive into today's show with the latest news and developments in technology behind crypto and blockchains. First, please don't forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, The Protocol, on Coindesk.com. And let's dive right into it. Today, we have a pretty incredible guest here, Anatoly Yakovenko. He is the CEO of Solana Labs and co-founder of Solana Network. Solana's been on quite a wild ride. Totally, I was just looking the token, for what it's worth, is up 791% over 1 year. After the recovering from the FTX collapse has been a big story, and market cap is approaching 90 billion, an all-time high now. It's been a pretty impressive run for Solana. And it's, we were just talking about it, was last week, the big story was the Ethereum Denkun upgrade. And this week, everybody's talking about Solana, which is kind of interesting. So we're super lucky to have Tolly here with us, joining from his home in San Francisco. And we got a pretty cool agenda here. We're going to just ask a couple general warm-up questions for Anatoly, and then we are Sam's going to lead some questions related to what we're seeing in terms of the meme coins on Solana, and then Margot's going to lead a little discussion about some of the comparisons with Ethereum. And then we're going to get back to, some comments about the stress test that Solana is having now with some of the transactions. People, maybe some complaints about some of the transactions not going through, and a little bit about the Solana roadmap. So totally, just for starters, to get us warmed up a little bit here. A lot of people probably know a lot about Solana. Some people probably don't know a ton. And about you too. You were co-founder of Solana starting April 2018, which is not an eternity, in blockchain time. In regular time. In blockchain time, it is a really long time. But then you had some interesting jobs kind of in some other tech, development areas in distributed systems before that. Just real quick, any thoughts on kind of, how you got to the point of starting Solana?
I mean, thanks for having me on the show, but yeah, founding story. I mean, I'm an engineer by trade. It's kind of what I've always been, I think. So I've always kind of tinkered. I went to Urbana-Champaign, like in Illinois, from 99 to 2003. So I overlapped the dot-com crash. And I remember like my advisor telling me that maybe computer science is a bad career choice and that software is kind of dead, which was interesting. And we had a startup there that was doing voice over IP stuff. And it was in the middle of Illinois, like after that .com crash, and we didn't know what we were doing, and it kind of petered out. But Qualcomm was hiring. They were building similar voice over IP stuff. And they, out of all the job offers, this was the only one where people were interviewing me in like board shorts and flip-flops in sunny San Diego. And I was like, that's the place to be. So that's how I ended up working on communications. But I was always, for whatever reason in my career, kind of slotted into like software performance optimizations, just kind of trying to optimize code, make it faster. Was one of the first kernel engineers in this operating system called Brew, which Qualcomm built for mobile phones. And this is flip phone era before smartphones. People thought we were crazy that there's going to be applications in these phones. The number one app at the time was ringtones. This is the only thing that people would download and pay for. And I remember the world kind of changed when the iPhone came out. We all knew kind of what that design is going to look like. There was this LG Prada device with a capacitive screen. No one remembers. That was like the first nice like touch-based device. We had this idea that you can get rid of the keyboard. All the stuff was on the tip of everyone's tongue, but Verizon and AT&T and all these big companies in the US thought that they get to design the phone for their network. So they would give us this 200-page spec of what a phone should look like. And it was not the iPhone. It was like the flip phone, but with like extra features or whatever, more ringtone stuff. And it was pretty cool to see Apple. I don't know if people remember any of this, but they bulldozed the industry. They refused to sell the devices through the phone, through the wireless companies. They sold them through their own stores. The whole experience was theirs. It was a Apple computer first and with a phone later. That was pretty cool. But how I ended up in crypto was 2017. I had a side project with a buddy of mine building deep learning hardware. We were setting up GPUs and mining crypto in the background. And this is before GPT. This is when the first time people figured out that deep learning could hallucinate and create weird like images. And I thought I was just always kind of a machine learning nerd. And we were mining crypto in the background. And it was weird to me that people were paying us to run these algorithms that did nothing. And I was aware of Bitcoin before. I was aware of Ethereum. Never really got into it until we started actually seeing that, holy shit, this is paying for a lot of GPUs for some reason. And this is when I started kind of going down the rabbit hole of really trying to understand proof of work, where why it's necessary, where all these constraints come from, and kind of got like more and more down the rabbit hole of what the system would look like if I was designing it. And then I had this eureka moment that there's a way to hash a data structure together that has a proof that time is passing. And this was something that if you worked at Qualcomm for like over a decade, this idea of time would have been just absorbed through osmosis. If you remember your physics classes, when two radio things transmit at the same time, you get interference because radio waves interfere with each other. But if you have two towers in cell phones, they give them a clock and they alternate them by time. That's the trick. It's a very, very simple trick. It's called time division multiple access. It's kind of like V0 cellular protocols, like 80s. We're talking like the first cellular networks, TDMA. So this is just a basic level optimization that you do with radio. And it was just kind of a light bulb. Oh man, there's a way to kind of get a sense of time in this open permissionless data, you know, like database that nobody has control over, that doesn't rely on the FCC to send goons when your tower is not doing its job. So that was really like the impetus for me to go like think about a little deeper. Okay, if I'm really going to do this, what does the system look like? What are we building for? And that was kind of it.
Thank you, Tully. That was really cool. All right, Sam, I'm going to throw it to you for the next couple questions.
Yeah. we saw Solana kind of crater due to its association with Sam Bankman-Fried and a bunch of other market things that were going on over the past few years, maybe the past year, year and a half. And now it's like really like a phoenix, our Dan Kuhn columnist said, risen from the ashes recently. And a lot of that can be attributed to this big craze around meme coins. And I'm curious just to kind of talk about this topic. First off, why do you think it's Solana rather than Ethereum or those layer two networks or any other of its competitors that has attracted all of this meme coin volume, all these dog coins and so on?
That I don't know. I have no clue. This is like the weirdest thing, is observing this from kind of like deep in the mines, working on like optimizing how fast bits move through these servers, and somebody at the top is like creating whatever random ass memes. I don't know. It's weird. Why do you guys, where do they even come from? Why do you guys think meme coins even have a life anywhere? Not just Solana. Like, to me, it's just a bizarre thing. I think of people being terminally online and kind of having nothing better to do.
So, I mean, do you think it's fair to say that a lot of Solana's recent meme coin craze has led to a sustainable growth or volume, liquidity rise for Solana that it's going to be able to see for the next 6 months, year, 2 years? Or do you think that this is just a blip that's going to disappear?
Also don't know. I don't know. This is like, for what it's worth, I think we're blessed to have this stress test now with meme coins instead of $1 trillion worth of stable coins. And I think my guess is within 5 years, there's going to be $1 trillion worth of stable coins in crypto. And that's an astronomical amount of real money that's now moving through these systems. And working out all the kinks now with memes is like a blessing. It's great. There's a there's a lot of demand, right, to access the network, and it's stressing the hardware, the protocols, all this stuff, and we get to see what, like, you know, the validators get to see what's not working, the core protocol engineers at Anza get to see what's not working and fix those bugs before we get to that like 1 trillion stablecoin watermark, which is going to be, I think, when you'll start seeing kind of the obvious. Oh yeah, crypto is obviously for payments because it's frictionless, it's fast, it's cheap, it's global. But we're not there yet. I like don't see meme coins as that much different than mobile gaming. Like, because I grew up my career in mobile, right? I was there for that transition from flip phones, from doing ringtones and nothing, to what mobile is today. Most people don't really realize this, but mobile gaming is $100 billion a year in spending. Like every year, there's $100 billion of revenue that people spend on loot boxes, effectively. A meme coin or an NFT is a transferable loot box. That's it. It's digital content that people buy for entertainment, and they happen to be transferable in crypto. They're not transferable in mobile. I don't think of it any more than that. And I think if you actually looked at how much spending occurs in crypto, it's probably less than 5% of the mobile gaming. If crypto actually scaled to the level of mobile gaming, the amount of, I think, memes and NFTs and the secondary effects of that, which hopefully are like high quality games and all this other stuff, is just going to grow exponentially.
Dolly, you know, one of the main talking points on Solana is just the fast and cheap transactions at the high level, right? And one question might be, if the meme coin traders, meme coin industry, if you will, is testing the limits of what is possible here.
So the network is just software and hardware. So it's provisioned to a certain capacity. And every time the load 10x's, it's going to hit that limit. And you're going to figure out, okay, this is where things, when you're redlining the engine, this is where they like don't work as well as they should. Fix them, you increase capacity, like you can handle more stuff. Why this doesn't happen on Ethereum is because Solana is philosophically is not a settlement network, right? It's built for execution, and everything is designed around, let's increase the capacity of the layer one. It's not about, let's change the protocols and the economics of the network to create layer twos. It's a bunch of hardware and software. If it does 20 million transactions per day with 12 cores, it's going to do 40 million transactions per day at 24 cores. That's it. So this is how, like, myself being, again, probably because my career has kind of colored my thinking, I think purely in terms of how many cores, how much execution throughput we can manage. And then the challenge is writing the software to get out of the way of the hardware. That's easier said than done, because as hardware gets higher throughput, it actually gets more complicated and more complicated to use effectively. So, but it's not a, like, it's not, I wouldn't call this computer science. This is computer, like, this is engineering. You have X amount of capacity that you need to hit. There's a certain amount of hardware that's going to get you there.
One obvious question here, where we keep on kind of talking about it, but not speaking about it directly. Solana has, with this big meme coin boom, seen a lot of stress for its network, as evidenced by, if you go to any of these Solana block scanners, you see not only some, but a vast majority of transactions on the network failing. So first off, why? What does it mean when a transaction fails? And why are so many transactions on Solana failing?
Yeah. So a failed status code is just what the application returns. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of transactions are actually not generated by users, but are generated by machines. Mm-hmm. And the machine can construct a transaction that has some probability of success. And if it succeeds, whoever wrote that script and that algorithm earns like a dollar, right? And if they send a transaction and it fails and it costs them one penny, they can send 100 of them, that one in 100 will earn a dollar. And they have only a 1% probability of success. It's still net positive for them to do that. So whatever the strategy they came up with, because Solana is so cheap and fast, you can do this at these like micro levels where you send 10,000 transactions, it costs you a dollar to do that, and one in 10,000 succeed and earn you that dollar. So the net effect of increasing throughput and lowering the cost of using the network, it makes it more accessible for machines, and machines will submit lots and lots of transactions. Some of them have a small probability of success.
My understanding is that there are a couple of problems for users when it comes to all of these transactions failing. There's the fact that priority fees and the priority fee market, the tip that you essentially pay to validators to have your transactions included, aren't always, you know, accounted for. So a lot of users are either paying too much for certain transactions to go through, or they're paying a lot and then not seeing those transactions go through. So let's start with the priority fees. Is there anything that Solana is going to do in terms of upgrades to address that side of the problem? Because I understand that users are being adversely impacted by this, which is why it's such a topic on Twitter among the Solana developer community.
So the median priority fee is 0.4 cents. Even the average fee is like 10 times that, is like 4 cents, right? So when a user has like this failure in Solana, it's more or less insignificant amount of money. When they have a failed transaction in Ethereum, it's hundreds of dollars potentially. Yeah, people see failing transactions sometimes, but the costs are astronomically different on Solana versus Ethereum. Developers that do submit, like that have services that submit lots and lots of transactions, those are the ones that are impacted the most. And because they submit so many transactions that a high failure rate does mean that their costs are high, right? But these are, I would say, businesses that are operating, that are using the network as they should be, that are dealing with issues. I would say that's kind of like separate classes of problems. There's a UX issue of a user submitting transaction, and the confirmation times right now, like if you look at like the validator's app or something like that, the median confirmation time is like 4 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And it can go up to like 10 seconds or 20 seconds. One single Ethereum block is 12 seconds. So what we're talking about is our scale is much, much faster and much, much cheaper. And when things get slower, it does impact users, especially users that are heavy traders that want to minimize their slippage and use those specific applications where the amount of time it takes to finalize a transaction, the market might have changed from what you assumed it was 10 seconds ago. And therefore, your transaction fails. And that's a bad user experience. So as the network kind of scales and matures, the protocols get better, capacity goes higher, and those numbers shrink both in terms of finality and cost, and the user experiences get better. But that just requires concretely, optimization and kind of more hardware.
Concretely, what are those changes? So there's going to be some changes, I understand, in the next upgrade around priority fees and fixing that market for users so some of these problems don't happen. There's also a lot of proposals, concrete and just broadly, around expanding block size. You've pushed for this. How do we actually make this happen on Solana? Can you just go into some of those upgrades briefly?
So there's a bunch of fixes to how transaction flow and scheduling works that are coming up in 1.18, and those should see some improvement. You don't know what it's going to be until it lands. The way that the release process works is that while there's a current mainnet release, whichever one I think it is, 1.17 today, 1.18 right now is in testing, and all the fixes for 1.17 that are now apparent go into 1.19. So you can kind of think of whatever problems you see today, they're going to be fixed, not in the next release, but the one after, because you have to test those fixes and soak them, and it takes time. And this is why Ethereum does about like one major release per year on Ethereum. There's three or four in Solana. So Solana moves quite a bit faster than that. But it's still not instant or immediate like you do in a website that like you run on Amazon, where you can just push changes to prod immediately. So a bunch of fixes are coming in 1.18. Those include changes to quality of service and scheduling, and we should hopefully see like some significant improvements. But until they land, it's really, really hard to know how much impact it's going to have and at what level of demand, right? Like, it's all software and hardware, right? At some point, it's redlining, and you start trying to figure out what is causing the undesired behavior. The easy solutions exist, but those create very, very high fees for users. And this is the mm-hmm. outcome that all the engineers and kind of everyone, all the businesses, everyone building on Solana does not want to see. Nobody wants Solana fees to go as high as Ethereum just to make it easier for that $200 fee paying transaction to land faster. That kind of defeats the whole purpose, right? It means that we've kind of failed at the big grand vision technology goal that you can increase capacity, you can lower fees, you can make these systems fast, and single giant atomic state machine without sharding, without any of this. So these are challenging constraints we put on ourselves, but people obviously see the benefit of it. Like, it's awesome to be in a single shared computer with everyone else versus in a bunch of little sharded systems.
That's great, Tolly. Thank you so much. Fascinating the way kind of you're explaining the logic behind how you go about addressing some of these issues. All right, we're going to take a break. And, you know, obviously a lot here, the comparison and contrast with Ethereum. And Mark is going to lead that discussion. We'll be right back.
Have a blockchain project idea and need funding to make it happen? Look no further. The Stellar Community Fund is here to help bring your project to life on the Stellar Network. This year alone, over $10 million in XLM awards have been allocated across more than 100 innovative projects. And your idea could be next. Approved project submissions can receive up to $100,000 in XLM per project. So head over to communityfund.stellar.org to get started.
Calling all developers. Score a Consensus 2024 Developer Pass for just $109, but act fast. Only a limited number of these passes are available. You may have heard that Consensus ain't for devs, but here's why you're wrong. Consensus is the only place you can fully immerse yourself in a multi-chain environment and learn directly from 20-plus chains, including Arbitrum, Chainlink, Solana, and more. Enjoy 3 days of intensive learning with technical talks, 40-plus expert speakers, and 20-plus in-depth workshops, including dedicated half-days for Ethereum and Bitcoin, and 3 full days of programming on our Protocol Village stage. Consensus 2024 is happening May 29th through 31st in Austin, Texas. Don't miss your chance to network at curated developer meetups find new career opportunities, and explore hundreds of site events and hacker houses around town. Grab your $109 developer pass today, but remember, this exclusive offer is limited. Visit consensus.coindesk.com now to secure your developer pass before they're gone. Explore the epicenter of blockchain innovation at Consensus 2024. All right, we're back with Anatoly Yakovenko of Solana, and we're going to move. I mean, you know, Tolly, you've been talking this whole time about some of the comparisons with Ethereum, which is interesting that you sort of acknowledge a lot of that competition head on and what you're after here, what we're really talking about. Okay, Margo, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, well, why don't we start with Tolly? There's been, you know, the news of the day is that Solana over the weekend had exceeded trading volume over Ethereum. And I think, you know, Solana's reputation, a lot of the times it's sort of compared to as like the Ethereum killer, as they say. I wanted to get your take, you know, to start off this conversation about, well, one, is Solana, is that what Solana is really competing with, like Ethereum as an L1? Or does it have to do with the entire ecosystem? Because as you mentioned earlier before in the break that, you know, L2s are not really part of your roadmap. But now with this meme coin craze, like we've seen that happen on Ethereum, Solana DeFi is obviously also booming. So yeah, I would love your intro take on all this.
Yeah, I mean, the Ethereum killer is just something I think the media came up with. It's always been, in my mind, Solana's focused on execution and transmitting information around the world and synchronizing it at the speed of light. Ethereum's focused on settlement. Mm-hmm. And if you were really focused on settlement, the kind of long-term roadmap of the design would look very much like Ethereum or Celestia, where you have these layer twos and data availability and all these other things. If you're focused on execution and you're trying to minimize like information entropy around the world, design would look like Solana, I hope, or we got it wrong, but I'm pretty sure we got it pretty close to right. So These are two different problems. And I think there's a lot of trade-offs you're making when you're picking one path or the other. There's really no reason why after Solana blocks are synchronized, why somebody like Wormhole that runs a bridge couldn't take them and put them into the Ethereum data availability layer and create a fraud-proof state route or whatever and make it look and feel like a L2. But from perspective of the user that's using Solana, things are synchronized first and fast and cheap on Solana. And if a bridge has an economic benefit from creating that additional level of security and trust, then it's worth building and they'll go earn fees on it, right? So like from kind of like, I think these are two separate visions. They're all competing because the use cases overlap, the features overlap. And that's fine, right? Like a user can do a swap in a market on Ethereum L1 or an Ethereum L2 or on Solana. And why they pick one or the other is going to be bajillion different reasons, right? That, you know, for whatever reason, they pick one or the other, who knows? But the visions are different enough that I think if like the big crypto future that everyone believes in, $1 trillion worth of stable coins across all these networks is going to come to pass, I think all the good Pareto efficient kind of designs are going to survive in some form or the other. There's going to be a fast execution chain. Hopefully it's Solana. There's going to be a settlement network. It's probably going to be Ethereum and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So as you'd sort of like identified that Solana is for the fast execution and Ethereum's for, in your eyes, the settlement, you know, Ethereum has like gone on this path of scalability and the roll-up centric roadmap, and it just had Dankun. And so they like, while L1 might not be that for Ethereum, there is a competing force with EIP 4844 and L2s. Like, does that change any dynamic in relation to Solana, especially as it's sort of viewed as like a blockchain for, you know, fast TPS?
Again, application developers are going to pick their trade-offs, right? There's a lot of devs that don't want to deal with the fragmentation of the L2 ecosystem and the design there, or they don't want to deal with the risk of a upgrade multisig on an L2 and things like that, right? Like the L2s are not yet perfect, and there's trade-offs. Like devs will pick one or the other. And there's obviously trade-offs with Solana. You have to buy bigger boxes. Like, you actually, it's a job to manage a Solana validator. It's not some, it's not something that you would, I would recommend people like run from home, even though some people can. So totally different networks. I think there's trade-offs for whatever. And it's up to the devs and the users to kind of pick one or the other.
I wanted to ask, just because, you know, we're in this chapter right now of Ethereum versus Solana. I'm the Ethereum reporter for CoinDesk, so that's sort of where I'm coming at from this angle. So I don't mean to be, you know, I know you're like, it's two different networks, but it is my job to sort of compare the two now that I have you in front of me, you know? Yeah. So
I'm a Golden State Warriors fan. I want him to play the Lakers, and I want LeBron to be on the Lakers, and still want the Warriors to win.
That's a great comparison.
I want Solana to compete with the best version of Ethereum and still win.
Sure.
And I think that's these designs are going to play out. I'm very confident in the way Solana is designed, because I have seen this kind of like technology ramp up happen multiple times in my career as an engineer. It's just people don't realize how fast Moore's Law is. A 2x improvement every 2 years is 1,000x every 20 years. It's 1,000 times better. Like, you think that these networks are like, 20 years seems like a very long time, but Bitcoin is already what, 12 years old, 13 years old, something like that. It's getting to that age where it's almost 20 years. Is it 1,000 times better than when it launched? If it's not, it means it's a dead technology branch. Now Bitcoin is building something very different. It's trying to be as simple as possible and a store of value. It's never going to have high TPS. It's very, very much selling a product that is rejecting that whole path, right? But if you're talking about scaling and usability, is there a technology component that's getting 1,000 times better every 20 years? If there's not, it's not a technology. It's something else. Bitcoin is something else, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I bring all this up and I wanted to bring up this, like, this comparison of scalability and evolving of technology, because I think it was a month ago at this point, there was the outage on Solana. And, you know, at this point, there's this meme or joke that every year there's this big outage on Solana, and you guys had almost made it to like the full 1 year. And, you know, we're sitting here comparing Ethereum versus Solana, and for better or for worse, I know you don't like the Ethereum killer narrative, but like, people do grasp onto that. And so, you know, as part of that, it's Solana is viewed as this, you know, fast functioning blockchain, but Ethereum has the security. And we were just talking about meme coins. And as, you know, we were sort of alluding to, there's this new like influx of volume on the network, growing the network, growing everything that's locked into the network. So these kind of outages sort of become like no longer acceptable, right? Like, Ethereum hasn't had an outage like that in years. So what, on the, you know, Solana Labs side or the devs side, are you guys doing to sort of ensure that, you know, as these volumes become, as this becomes more serious, right? Like, this kind of outage would be very, I mean, continues to be very serious.
There's absolutely nothing that an outage could do to convince Circle to wire out your dollars without your cryptographic signature. There's nothing that, even if 100% of the Solana stake was corrupted and malicious and controlled by an adversary, there's nothing they can do to convince Circle to wire out your USDC. So the security of these systems does not depend on the quorum or liveness. Liveness depends on the quorum. And you can only guarantee liveness to a point, up to a certain number of faults. But when you're talking about security and safety, Circle runs their own nodes. They're well connected. They secure their own nodes. That's all the security they need. And they can issue $1 trillion worth of stable coins on Solana, and it doesn't matter what the quorum does. There's nothing they can do to like mess with that. So this is why these systems are so revolutionary, is that it doesn't depend on the majority of the network for security. But it still provides this shared environment. And this is very, very different than any other shared system that anyone's ever built. It's very different. This is why it's different from AWS or cloud or whatever. You're not relying on a trusted third party. Like, Circle can't trust AWS with $1 trillion worth of stable coins, right? This is why this financial revolution is happening in these networks. And this isn't true about only Solana. Every layer one has this. If a well-designed layer one, all of them should have this like capability. So what we're talking about is liveness. Outages suck. They interrupt businesses. It's like when Verizon was down or Facebook was down, a bunch of people depend on it and they suck, right? And all of engineering is trying to improve reliability while also improving performance without increasing fees. So that's a grind. The biggest change I would say that's happening is that there's a second implementation of the Solana client that's being built. What's really awesome about Ethereum is that there's four implementations. So when one of them had a bug, you had still liveness, people are still making blocks, but you were not getting full confirmation on Ethereum mainnet, while those core engineers could fix that one client bug and things could come back. That's really cool. So if Solana can get there, it's just code, more code. You can solve all your problems with more code sometimes. If you can, you're in a very, very lucky place. So this particular problem is solved by more clients. So FireDancer is a second implementation. It's being built by a team out of Jump. They're awesome. They're not only are they building a second client, they're also building a hyper optimized version of Solana so we can demonstrate that the protocol, given enough hardware and the right software improvements, can scale to whatever TPS you want. That's happening. My guess, engineering timelines are always, never trust an engineer about their timelines. But basically my guess is 50% chance that they'll have like a full node on mainnet by breakpoint. So
yeah, I think one of the things that people have come to Solana for historically has just been kind of what you're alluding to here, which is that Solana has taken a more product-minded approach in the minds of many than Ethereum or many of its rival networks have that have kind of come out, you know, through these immaculate conception type stories. I mean, Ethereum less so than Bitcoin, but that kind of has, I think, helped Solana be nimble in a way that other ecosystems haven't. But kind of shifting gears a little bit, because we are running a little bit shorter on time, I want to talk a little bit about the Solana phone. So you launched the first Solana phone a while back, didn't really see many sales, and then meme coin craze happens. People realize they can sort of arbitrage these phones for these bonk tokens that were attached to the phones. Anyway, that happens. Solana phone one does great. We see Solana phone number two, and you get over 100,000, I think, pre-orders. I wonder, like, what do you attribute that to? And do you think that there's real users, or is it an airdrop thing? Are people just trying to farm again?
People that had bonk sold their bonk and bought the phone because they knew they were going to get the same amount of bonk back. So it was not an efficient arbitrage to buy the phone, wait 1 to 3 weeks to get the phone, then claim the airdrop, which everyone in crypto knows the volatility of that is like very, very much not certain. But people that were like already in bonk and super bullish on bonk were like, okay, I'm going to get this stupid phone and I can pay for it with the bonk that I already have because I know I'm going to get my bonk back, right? And that was the thesis that we had. It's a very, very weird thesis. So basically, like, crypto is talking about disrupting the banks that are, you know, have very tight profit margins and charge like bips on transfers, while Google and Apple charge 20 to 30% on all digital payments in their ecosystems. So we're talking like, what is that, 1,000x difference? Mm-hmm. So there is this payments ecosystem called the Apple iOS App Store and the Google Play Store, and their fees are 20 to 30% on digital content. It's insane. It's astronomical. That means that when developers build games for those, they have 20 to 30% fewer engineers and designers and artists working in those games. 20 to 30% fewer games get built, like, because Apple and Google take such a huge rate. It's a massive inefficiency. And our thesis was that, okay, this is so bad, and they can never really enable crypto because of it, because this idea of transferable loot boxes breaks the whole model. Magic Eden or Tensor can't sell an NFT for $10,000 on their website, but $13,000 in the iOS App Store. Because the price disparity is so large, no user is actually going to, it's going to be really, really bad UX for a user to buy something in the iOS store that's $3,000 cheaper on the web. And Tensor can't eat that fee, right? They can't eat that fee like movie producer can, when they create content and they just create copies of it for digital distribution through these app stores. This is the really, really weird, bizarro thing that idea of digital ownership is really subverting, that you can't run these app stores with these massive fees anymore. That's our thesis. And the way to like take advantage of it is that we give out hardware. It has some goodies for crypto users, a seed vault, so you can't leak your seed phrase to the applications, app store with no fees. And the hope is that developers are so excited about this idea of no fees that they can give out their digital content, because when they launch applications, they can actually do that. They're like, sure, I'll airdrop to these phone holders. Therefore, I now have access to users, don't have those crazy fees. And because these digital assets are transferable and ownable by the users, it is effectively subsidizing the phone. And that was the thesis. Like, can this actually scale? We worked to 20,000 users. We got 115,000 or whatever pre-orders for the Chapter 2. So we'll see when that launches what the effects are going to be. And then like the big unknown is, can it actually be built into a sustainable business model where we can build awesome hardware and developers actually want users to use it? If that happens, then we have a flywheel, right? Because no dev wants to, like, every dev that has like a mobile game knows that you have like 1 to 5% of your users generate 80 to 90% of your volume. If you can take that 1 to 5% and get them to convert to an app store with no fees, you can actually, for a very small amount of work, you can convert massive amounts of, like, save massive amounts of revenue, right? So we'll see if that happens. It's a big unknown. It's a risk worth taking, though, because I think, I don't know, this was not planned, but when we announced Chapter 2, like, Tim Sweeney was, like, posting all these disheartened messages about the Supreme Court siding with Apple and stuff, and basically screwing Epic over. Probably, it's crazy, right? Like, in my mind, this is the least competitive market we have in the U.S. right now are the digital content marketplaces on Google and Apple.
I'm not sure. Yeah, media companies competing with them, losing. Any rate, this is, I mean, it's just fascinating how everything is an experiment. You know, it's the technology is an experiment, and also the marketing and the business strategy itself is kind of an experiment in some ways. But totally, thank you so much. We should wrap it there, and hopefully this will be the first of several times, many times that you'll join us. Thank you so much. And thank you, Margot and Sam. That is a wrap for this episode of the Protocol Podcast. Thanks to our producer, Michelle Musso, our booker, Mel Montañez. If you have any questions about any stories or comments, please reach out to us at podcasts@coindesk.com. Subject line, The Protocol. You can listen to us weekly on Coindesk Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, subscribe to our weekly newsletter, The Protocol, on coindesk.com. And I'll just add that if you want to know what information entropy is, I did Google that while we were talking, and I immediately got to a lot of Greek letters. So I'm going to spend a little time, but that's on Wikipedia if you want that. Anyway, see you next week.